I invite you to open your Bibles and to John chapter 9. Today we're going to look at the story of how Jesus gave sight to a blind man. I want you to think, have you ever thought about how difficult your life would be if you were blind? All right, I'm going to ask you to do something. You might feel uncomfortable with this, whatever. I'm just going to ask you to close your eyes. Pretend your eyes don't work. And now just think about what life would be like if you were always blind. I want you to think about even this church service, singing songs. That would be difficult. You have to memorize a lot. I want you to just think about even navigating your way outside of the auditorium. We have snacks after church. How would you get your snacks? Maybe someone would give you snacks, and then they'd be placed in your hand. How do you even know it's there? Maybe you're told, but then it seems messy, getting food to your mouth. And then a ride. You would need someone to give you a ride. How do you navigate the steps? How do you get out into the car for your ride home? What if you need to use the restroom here before you go? Like, how do you navigate? What if you're in a strange place trying to navigate restrooms? What about this morning? If your eyes didn't work, how would you know what time to get up? How would you know that your clothes match? Finding your breakfast food and eating your breakfast food all in the dark. And if you had any hope of trying to live independently, what would that be like? Arranging things in your house, how easy you could lose things if you just didn't quite put them where they need to be. Or if you had to get out and about to go some shopping, crossing streets, public transportation, paying for things at Walmart or food at McDonald's, or trying to use a computer or a phone. How do you do those things? Okay, you can open your eyes. It'd be hard. Amen? It'd be really hard. And these are just the beginnings of the questions of what it means to navigate life as a blind person today. Now, our society gives lots of help to blind people. The Americans with Disabilities Act, United States, ensure people with disabilities have equal access to public spaces, to education, to employment and services. Public buildings have Braille that people can read in elevators and bathrooms so they don't walk into the wrong bathroom. Schools provide assistance, adaptive technology. Financial help is often for those with economic hardship to reduce that. Audible traffic signals, like if you've ever been walking and it's loud, like the reason why it's loud is because we want to cater to blind people. Transportation systems have been designed with blind people in mind. Many businesses have initiatives to figure out how blind people might work in their company in a way that could truly add value with their skills. Perhaps phone work, different sorts of things like that. In our society, we have a public awareness campaigns to help us realize the plight of disabled people. Sports have even been adapted for blind people. You know there's such a thing as blind soccer? Ball's got little ring, it jingles, and so you got it. But the crowd's got to be totally quiet. You think about rock or soccer, right? Real loud crowd, you're like shh, and they get there, and they do have some coaches on either side and along the sideline to try to catch. And these guys wear masks, even when they're blind, they put on masks and they kind of go around. It was in the Olympics this year, the disabled Olympics. Being blind in our society is difficult, but it's nothing like being blind in Bible times. No Americans for Disability Act, no Braille, no school assistance, no financial help, exclusion from society. If you are blind, you're a beggar. It's the only really chance that you had. And Jesus encountered such a blind beggar man in our text. If you look, if you got your Bibles open, I encourage you to do that. John chapter 9 and verse 1. You see here, he passed by. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. Okay, so a new chapter gives us reason for a new picture. We've got pictures, chapters 1 through 8, 1 through 9 so far here. And here's the picture of the blind man. Now, that's a cane. It looked like an old man. It's not like a walking blind man stick, but you sort of get the idea. That this is a picture in chapter 9. Chapter 9 is all about the man born blind. The title of my message comes from verse 25, when this blind man simply says, "One thing I know, that though I was blind, now I see." Now, when the disciples here in verse 2 saw the blind man, they didn't feel compassion upon this beggar and give him money. Instead, they used him as an object lesson to stir up a theological question they had for themselves. Verse 2 said this, "And his disciples asked him, 'Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?'" Now, first of all, this just showed great insensitivity to this man on behalf of the disciples. I mean, from the context, it appears that this man certainly would have heard these disciples ask that question. Think about how that made the blind man feel. But you know what? A beggar is so debased and down, he'd probably like, "Yeah, whatever." And the disciples are like, "Yeah, whatever." I mean, think about how you'd feel if you had a child with Down syndrome, and after church, right, you're standing with your child, and I come and I greet you, and then someone comes along and says, "Pastor Steve, who sinned, this boy or his parents?" How'd you feel? How would the child feel? That's what happened here. Who sinned, this man or his parents? But he was so far down on the societal pole, I don't know if it really bothered him so much, but it showed the insensitivity of the time. And I can see why they asked the question. Remember a picture in chapter 5 of the man in the wheelchair, the paralytic who was healed? This paralytic was sitting by the pool waiting for the angel to stir the water so he could be the first one in to be healed, according to the tradition of the day. And Jesus approached him and said, "Do you want to be healed?" Of course he wanted to be healed. For 38 years, the man couldn't walk. Of course he wanted his legs to work again. That's why he's sitting by the pool, so he could try to be the first one in order to be healed. But seemingly he could never get into the pool fast enough, and as a result, he had little hope of being healed. But to this man, Jesus said in John chapter 5, verse 8, "Get up, take your bed, and walk." He did. He hadn't walked for 38 years. He stands up, and he picks up his bed, puts it on his shoulder, and he walks. Later, Jesus found him in the temple. In chapter 5, verse 14, he said, "See, you are well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you." Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you. And the implication being that sin brought the paralysis upon him. And the promise of further sin would bring him to a worse place. Like, I'm not sure how worse it can be, not being able to walk for 38 years. Would you rather be the lame man or the blind man? I think I'd rather be the blind man. This guy's situation was worse. And he said, if you're sin no more, lest something worse be happened to you. In other words, right, it's a sin that brought his great suffering. And since this man in chapter 9 was born blind, the disciples imagined surely it was sin that caused his blindness. And the difficulty these disciples had was did he sin in the womb? Or was it because something his parents did? Now, they presented Jesus with either or, him or the parents, and not realizing that it was our sin, meaning human sin, is why he was born blind. Not these particular sins, but Jesus even focuses on something deeper than that. He says in verse 3, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him." The disciples had totally missed it. It wasn't because this man sinned. It wasn't because his parents sinned. He was born blind. It was because God had a work in mind, and God had his glory in mind, which we'll see as the chapter unfolds. Like, spoiler alert, Jesus is going to give him sight. We're going to see that. But before we see that, I want to linger here. That the works of God might be displayed in him. Do you have a category for that in your worldview? That God would bring suffering upon a man for his own glory. This blind man here is called a man. In Jewish circles, you become a man at your bar mitzvah, son of the commandments, when you become 13. But the man at the pool of Bethesda was also called a man. He was 38 years old. So I don't know. I sense he's maybe in his 20s. So it's a total guess. But we can picture him as 20, not 38, not 13, somewhere in between. We're guessing 20 years or so, he'd suffered impact of blindness, excluded from society, no financial help, a beggar through zero fault of his own, is what Jesus said. Through no fault of him, no fault of his parents, but God brought it so he can bring forth his works. Do you have a category for that worldview? It's clear as a bell in this text. And I contend that God is doing far more even that we see, bringing suffering for his glory. He did it with Jesus, our hope of the gospel. God brought suffering for his glory. God brought suffering to show forth his works. He sent his son to face the most undeserved, the most cruel injustice that anyone on earth has ever experienced for God's glory. Jesus was the only perfect, righteous man to walk on the planet, yet he experienced the greatest injustice that anyone ever faced, crucifixion. And it's not that crucifixion was unusual. I mean, that's how the Romans often executed criminals. In fact, two criminals were being executed with crucifixion at the very same time. But what had made it cruel to Jesus was his totally unjust. Totally unjust. Jesus deserved none of this suffering that he endured. To add to that, his crucifixion was even worse than the criminals. Not only did he die on the cross, but he died for our sins. That is, he died experiencing God's wrath in his body on the cross that we might go free. It was our sin that put Jesus on the cross. Now, why this injustice? Why this suffering? For the glory of God. That he might bring sinners to himself like us, that by faith we might stand in his presence someday. It's the gospel. But it's Jesus suffering unjustly for God's glory to bring us to Christ. And yet somehow, sometimes when it comes to our suffering, we can easily miss God's hand and his purpose in it. James calls us to rejoice in our suffering. James 1, 2 through 4. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you encounter trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let steadfastness, this endurance, have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. God refines us by the trials that he brings into our lives, that we might stand perfect and complete before him, lacking in nothing. God designs suffering in our life because it produces steadfastness, that all might be to his glory. See, conforms us more and more to the image of Christ. That's the little category, like verse 3. But let's get back to this blind man. He suffered for decades, and all for the glory of God and his healing. Now, before he actually heals, he sets the stage. Look at verse 4. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Jesus says, I'm the light of the world. I'm going to shine my light through the work while I have time. While I'm here, I'm going to do what I am about to do. He's kind of just setting it up. I'm the light of the world. This man is living in darkness with eyes shut. I'm going to open him up so he can see light. And then verse 6, we see my first point here. I'm simply calling it healing. It's really come from verses 1 through 7. It's all gearing up here. The introduction to this blind man, and then talking about this blind man and his sin that caused him to be blind, and then Jesus setting it up, and now the healing in verse 6. Having said these things, Jesus spit on the ground. He made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with mud and said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. Picture what Jesus did. He stooped down. He spit in the dirt, and he mixed some of that dirt. Kind of, he couldn't have been much with just his saliva. Couldn't have been much. And then he takes that dirt, and he puts it on the eyes of this blind man, and he says, go wash. And the guy goes and washes. Actually, it was anointed with the mud. And he goes, he washes that off, and he came back seeing. It's amazing, is it not? Jesus, the light of the world, gives light to this man's blind eyes. What optometrist would not die to have this sort of power? I just need to spit in the ground? That's all I need to do? Now, what exactly Jesus did to heal this man's eyes, we don't know. Maybe he had cataracts, just like something cloudy there, and just remove the clouds. Maybe he had a severed optic nerve and Jesus, in both eyes, put the optic nerve back. Maybe he had macular degeneration and restored the macula. Well, we don't know, but whatever took place, it was utterly amazing. In fact, the blind man will tell us how amazing it is. Look down at verse 30. The blind man said, "This is an amazing thing. You don't know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Yet never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind." How amazing this is. Never in the history of the world has this ever happened. And this happened today to me. That's what he's saying. How amazing this is. And it's amazing as this miracle is. That's all that John says about this miracle. Just these two verses, verses 6 and 7. Five verses leading up to the healing, two verses about the healing, and the rest of the chapter shows what happened after the miracle. So it might lead a little bit what the importance is. The importance isn't so much the miracle. The importance in John is what happened after the miracle, what the rest of this chapter describes. And what we're going to see is then the Pharisees interacting with this man who was born blind. We're going to see hostility from the Pharisees, like we saw in chapter 8. Same thing's going to carry over here to chapter 9. We're going to see some hesitation on the behalf of people. Like, is this really, like, what's happening here? We're going to see some honesty, especially from the blind men. But they're all so mingled together that my second point is actually three points. Hesitation, hostility, and honesty. And I want you just to think about those, because they're going to kind of like all be there. There's themes here as we see the response in verses 8 through 14 through 41. Now, however, before we dig into those verses to see that, I just want to ask you a question. Why did Jesus heal the man this way? I mean, why did he spit in the dirt to make mud to put it on the man's eyes? He didn't have to. I mean, if you look at the miracles of Jesus, he does it all different ways. And I think he does it all different ways, lest we think that there's a formula to what Jesus is doing. Lest we think, oh, eyes, spit in the mud. Oh, this kind of healing, oh, we lay our hands on him. Oh, this kind of healing, we do, like, it's not formula. Jesus can do whatever he wants. Like he did to the paralytic. He didn't even touch him, but he saw him, and he says, "Get up, take up your bed, and walk." And he got up and took up his bed and walked. That was him. Jesus can heal from miles away. Do you guys remember the 1 o'clock miracle from chapter 4? Jesus was at Cana when the royal official traveled from Capernaum, those 20 miles, to see Jesus. And he pleaded for the life of his son, was on his deathbed. And Jesus, without meeting him or knowing him, just said, "Go, your son will live." And he was healed at that moment. And as he went back up to Capernaum, down to Capernaum, I can't remember whether it's up or down, which one's in the hill. One of them's in the hills. When he got back to there, he was healed at that very time. It was 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So Jesus didn't have to make mud and the dirt spit to anoint the man's eyes so he could see. So why did he do it? I think he did it because it was the Sabbath. And because he knew that this sort of thing was not really lawful to do on the Sabbath. According to Jewish tradition at the time, according to the oral tradition, it prohibited any kind of kneading on the Sabbath, any kind of mixing. So you can't make any bread that you would like mix things together with. You can't make any cakes, right? You can't mix ingredients together, regardless how big or how small your mixture was. That's how fastidious these Pharisees were. Even a little bit of dirt and a little bit of saliva was enough to stir these Jews against Jesus, call him a Sabbath breaker. I believe Jesus did this miracle on the Sabbath, breaking the Sabbath, so it's just to provoke these Sadducees, these Pharisees rather, intentionally. This past week, I saw an illustration of that. It was about a week and a half ago. My son-in-law was asked by a friend if he wanted to go outside, that the weather's getting nice. This is like late February, and it was unseasonably warm. And he says, "Hey, I got this sign. You wanna come and just, we'll put the sign up and we'll just kind of stand up and we'll talk to people. You want to do that? You guys up for that?" Matt, what's your question? There it is. This is what the sign said. "Abortion is murder. Forgiveness for murder can be found in Jesus Christ alone." pretty provocative sign, I think. Yes. Why would you take such a sign and stand outside downtown with such a sign if you didn't want to provoke people to a reaction? And hopefully maybe to provoke a discussion about abortion. Why would Jesus spit in the dirt, cause some mud on the Sabbath to heal it? He wants to provoke these Pharisees to see what's going on. So my son-in-law did. And there he was in front of this jewelry store. And boy, did he get a reaction. So I talked to him Friday I talked to him. And he said, well, we got there, we put the sign up, and within 2 minutes, this woman came by and said, F you, you effing fascists. But that's not exactly what she said. But you get my, like, within 2 minutes, like, whoa, where that's coming from. I bring this up because this is exactly the attitude and demeanor of these Pharisees that they had when Jesus healed on the Sabbath. But not all actions were so hostile. My son-in-law told me that for the most part, people simply walked by and they gave a thumbs up or they gave a thumbs down. It depended upon where they were on the political spectrum. And he really summarized it well. He says, well, we either got a thumbs up or we got the bird, is kind of what he said. That's what the sign did, right? It provoked people. And that's what Jesus was doing in this miracle. He was provoking them. And my son-in-law did have some profitable conversation. At one point, a young man and a young woman, I'm not sure if these were like they're covered over just so they're not seen. But he said a young man and a young woman came by and she said something like, well, of course, late-term abortion should be wrong. I mean, like, 8 months a lot for sure, that should be wrong. And this, my son-in-law and his friend engaged him in a conversation, just said, right? Okay, well, if 8 months is clearly wrong, then what about 7 months? That's probably wrong, too. What about 5 months? What about 3 months? What about 8 weeks? What about 2 weeks? Where is it okay? Where is it not okay? Where is it okay? And he said, where should we draw the line? And she said, I'm not really sure. I've never really thought about that before. And then my son-in-law said, well, shouldn't you maybe play it safe if a human life is on the line? And that conversation that they had that ended like provoking a good, that of best scenarios, that's what was tried to do with this sign, leading a profitable conversation where she'd think about things she hadn't considered before. And then later an older liberal woman approached. What are you trying to accomplish with this sign? And they said, we're just trying to provoke conversations with other people. And said, don't you think people are thinking about this already? And he said, well, actually not. We just had this conversation with someone who hadn't really thought about it. And just that softened her up. And they had a conversation. I don't think they persuaded her, certainly didn't persuade her, change her. But it was more polite than hostile. But there's no doubt the sign was provoking, like the way that Jesus healed this blind man. Now, the only reason I know this picture here, and this is what happened, is because it was on Facebook. So this isn't his Facebook. This is someone else's Facebook who took this picture, posted a picture of what happened. And this woman, I don't know why I scratched out her name, but I did, whatever. She wrote in her post, couple of men in Uptown Normal spending their day, Friday, February 28th, judging pregnant people for what they do with their bodies. They have the right to stand around with a sign. I just want to highlight the patriarchy and theocracy of it all. And I looked at it this morning. There were 106 comments. Some of the comments right here, right? One said, dorks. The other said, losers. Another said, weird and disgusting, creepers, men. Some were funny. You kids might like this one. Michael, Michelle Perez. Wish I had known it, but they would have been there. I would have loaded up on beans and stood in front of them. Another one said, I need to start carrying around tomatoes and cabbage. And then one says, I have eggs in a fast car. One comment was super helpful. I wonder how many children they foster. It's challenging for all of us. Pro-life people should be pro-foster care and pro-adoption. Contribute to that work of that, labor for that, for sure. It's a great, great comment. But most of them were hostile, like this one. Nazis in Uptown Normal. Some were dangerous and threatening. Have we doxed them yet? You guys know what dox means? It means basically putting his address out there so that you can go to his house and whatever, throw eggs or wait for him or harm him or key their car or whatever. Just like, that's doing that. But throughout the entire thread of the 106 comments, the vast majority of them were this flavor, like hatred spewing forth the hostility that we'll see these Pharisees against Jesus and this man who was born blind. One comment read, and I thought this was helpful, using your First Amendment rights to call attention to injustice is a great use of your time. Using those same rights to shame people isn't. Like, there's the voice of reason trying to, this is why you guys aren't on Facebook, right? That's right. All this, whatever. I just say this in illustration, though, to show a real sense of the hostility and the honesty and the hesitation that Jesus faced when he healed this man who was born blind. Because we're going to see outwardly hostile people. We're going to see some people not quite sure what to think. We're going to see some people honest what they thought. So I'm just going to dig through this. We're just going to walk through this, the rest of this chapter like super quick in our time remaining. Okay, look at verse 8. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar. So these beggars were at the same places almost all the time. They just got used to it. They could walk there. They could get there. They could be placed there. And beggars became a pretty stable, like, furniture, I guess, on the place up to the temple. They just knew where they were. A little bit like people begging, whatever, panhandling today. You're like the same people you might see at the same streetlights because you know that that's where they are. The neighbors, right, those who were around, and those who'd seen him before as a beggar, they'd seen him. Is this not the man who used to sit and beg? Verse 9, some said, it is he. Others said, no, but he is like him. He kept saying, I am the man. It's me. It really is. And I trust you see the hesitation going on in these verses, people trying to discern the facts about the situation. Is this really the one, or does it sort of look like him? I mean, beggars are well known at that time, same spot. But I'd imagine that the countenance of this man was a little bit different. If you've ever seen blind people, maybe they keep their eyes shut. Maybe their eyes are kind of glassy, and but all of a sudden this guy can see, so his eyes are like attentive, and that would have changed his whole countenance. Like, that sort of looks like him, but is that really him? I can see the hesitation here. But the blind man kept insisting that it was him. I'm the man. And so verse 10, they said to him, then how were your eyes opened? He answered, the man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, go to Siloam and wash. And so I went and washed and received my sight. And here you see the blind man just being honest with everyone in his story. Jesus anointed my eyes, told me to wash. I did. And now I see. That's his testimony. It's his experience. At this point, that's all he's got. And they said to him, where is he? I don't know. Like, okay, so picture this. He's blind and someone anoints his eyes, says, go and wash. He's blind, right? He doesn't, and then he goes and he washes and he can see, and all of a sudden, where's Jesus? You're asking the blind man where Jesus is. You know, it's humorous. This story is humorous. And then verse 13, we see the hostility of Jesus begin to ramp up as these men brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been born blind. And it was a Sabbath day when Jesus had made mud and opened his eyes. That verse 14 is the key. It was a Sabbath day. This statement is a little bit like chapter 5 and verse 9, which says, after he healed the lame man, now that day was the Sabbath. This was the Sabbath day when all of this happened. And they brought this man to the religious leaders for their thought and guidance. These were the religious leaders. How are we supposed to think about this? Like, what's supposed to happen about this? How are we supposed to process this unusual situation? What do you think about it? And then how are we to think about this? And at first, the Pharisees simply trying to get the facts, trying to understand what happened. That's what we see in verse 15. So the Pharisees again asked him how he'd received his sight. And he said, he put mud on my eyes and I washed and I see. And then the hostilities comes in verse 16. Some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. How blind can they be?
But others said, how can a man who's a sinner do such things? And there was a division among them, right? So some were hesitating, some were like hostile and trying to figure out what exactly took place. Some called Jesus Sabbath breaker. Others pointed the incongruity with this. So verse 17, so they said again to the blind man, what do you say about him since he opened your eyes? And the blind man said, he's a prophet. And so he was just a man who healed. Now all of a sudden he's a prophet. As this blind man, just in his honesty, is processing through these things. He's like, well, this is pretty special. I think he's a prophet. And the investigation continues, the interrogation maybe, if you will, in verse 18. The Jews did not believe that he had been born blind and had received his sight. They thought there was some trickery here, right? Some miracle crusade where someone just pretends, right? They walk up on stage, you know, like this with a crutch. And this is how much faith healing happens today, right? They walk up there like that, and the faith healer like hits their head, they fall back, and then they start walking, I can walk, and they throw their crutch away. They were never lame to begin with. And that's what they say. This guy was never blind to begin with, is what they're saying. And so they called the parents of the man. Was this guy really just playing a game with us, or was he really blind? Verse 19, they asked him, is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he now see? Two questions. First question, parents answered, we know that this is our son and that he was born blind. We know that. But the second question, how now does he see? We do not know, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him. He's of age. He will speak for himself. Now, it's interesting, their hesitation on behalf of the parents, there's more going on here than them just saying no. They said, yes, this is my son. Now he sees. And rather than just embracing Jesus and embracing this miracle, verse 22, they were scared. The parents said these things because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be the Christ, he should be put out of the synagogue. They feared being de-synagogued. And for them, like, the being out of the synagogue would be awful. It's put out of society, expelled, the outcasts. If you're uniting with Jesus, you're going to be gone. So, like, this intimidation, right? You unite with Jesus, you're out of the synagogue. Just anytime a religious organization needs to put pressure on what you do in order to be still in the club, you're like, that's bad news. And that's what they're doing, putting pressure on them to still be in. And they were not willing to stand by the story of their son about Jesus being the reason for their healing because of the consequences that would happen. That's why they said in verse 23, he's of age, ask him, like just diverting it. And at this point, the parents weren't ready to side with Jesus and their son, so they hesitated. And then in verse 4, they called the man in again who'd been healed, and their blatant hostility of Jesus is clear for all to see. Look at verse 24. So, for the second time, they called the man who'd been born blind, and they said, give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner. So basically, call him a sinner. And he answered, whether he's a sinner or not, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see. And I love the statement of the blind man. He diffuses the accusation of the Pharisees claiming ignorance and inability to make any set statement against Jesus. Right? Whether he's a sinner, I don't know. Like, I don't know enough about him to be qualified to comment on that. You've commented on that. I don't know. But then he gives his testimony. The one thing he does know for sure is that once I was blind, and now I see. So he speaks the truth of what it is that he knows. In fact, that's the core of our text, the title of my message this morning, I Was Blind, Now I See. This man's being totally honest. Simply told these religious leaders what he experienced. I used to be a blind. In fact, I was out there by the East Gate. I was there for many, many years. But now I can see like the rest of you. I can go and walk wherever I want to go. The Pharisees weren't satisfied with that, just with his own testimony. They said, verse 26, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? And he answered, I've told you already. In fact, I think he's told them twice in the first interview. He said, I've told you several times, you would not listen. Do you want to hear it again? And then he begins to dig, right? Do you want to be his disciples? And that was too much for them. But I love his boldness. Unlike his parents, he didn't have, right, what you call it, stick in the game? I'm not even sure. He didn't have a stake in the game? What's it called? A fight. A dog in the fight. He didn't have a dog in the fight, right? He's like been expelled already. So to get out of the synagogue, like he's practically been out of the synagogue already since he's this lowly sinner beggar. He had nothing to lose. And it seems like almost here, he's decided to follow Jesus already. He'd follow this man who gave him sight, and rightly so. And I think we can even learn from that just how Jesus said, blessed are the poor in spirit, for there's the kingdom of heaven, right? Blessed are those who got nothing to lose, but all they do is they go to Jesus. Difficult for rich men. Difficult for people with reputations. Difficult for that. But not for a poor man who's an outcast. How good is it for us to be in a place of lowliness? Have nothing to lose. Everything is in for Jesus. The Pharisees, though, were having nothing of it when he said, you want to become his disciples? Here we have hostility meeting honesty. Verse 28, then they reviled him, saying, you are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from. Now, if you remember back in chapter 5, they weren't disciples of Moses because Jesus had said to them, if you believe Moses, you would also believe me, for he wrote of me. John chapter 5, verse 46. If you believed his writings, you believe me. Well, we follow Moses, but the fact they don't believe Jesus shows that they're not really followers of Moses. But that's what they claim. But for this man, we don't know where we're of Moses. We don't know where he's from. He's just kind of from who knows where. But the blind man didn't back down. He said, verse 30, I've quoted this already, right? Why? This is an amazing thing. You do not know where he came from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God, he does his will. God listens to him. He's just putting forth proper categories. We know, like the Psalms speak about, right? If I just have wickedness in my heart, you will not hear me. I think that's Psalm 68. But if anyone's right, God hears the prayer of the righteous, and he knows that enough. And then it says in verse 32 that never since the world began has been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. Like, he's just putting forth simple logic about the situation. And I say there's much to learn here about evangelism. Speaking for Jesus doesn't mean that you need to have all the answers to all the questions that anyone might ask you. Evangelism is about boldness, being willing to tell others of what you know. And it may be a little bit. It may be like this blind man says, I don't know, but all I know is I was blind and now I see. It's interesting, the blind man knew that nobody in history had been born blind. I'm not sure how well he knew the prophecy. The Pharisees certainly knew the prophecy, Isaiah 35, verse 5 and 6, when the Messiah comes. It says, Isaiah 35, 5, the eyes of the blind shall be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap like a deer and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. He didn't quote it. He didn't need to. Maybe he didn't know it. But what he did know, he said. And what he did know was enough to convict and pierce the hearts of these people. He did know that he was blind and now he sees. All he needed to know was that Jesus is the one who came and healed him. All he needed to know is that God is the one who did a work in his life. Jesus said that we must work the works of him who sent me. And he was a work of God was done in his life. And we can learn much about evangelism from a man who was born blind. He didn't know what much, but what he knew he spoke. How much do you know? You don't need to know a lot. But what you do know, you need to speak. Verse 33 again. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. That's what he said. It's clear as a bell to him. He couldn't do anything if it wasn't. He must be from God. That's why he's a prophet, as he's thinking through these things. And they answered him, verse 34, you were born in utter sin, and would you teach us? And they cast him out. So they come back to the very thing that the disciples came back to. Whose sin was it? And, sexually transmitted disease sometimes bring blindness upon people. And maybe that was what they were thinking about. Your parents are sinners, and maybe so. Maybe sexual immorality brought him into this world. They call him a sinner. They're just like they talked Jesus in John chapter 8. We saw that last week where they called him a son of fornication. Maybe that's what they're accusing this guy here, being born in sin, right? Cast out. Yeah, they're just trying to discredit him. It's called an ad hominem argument. Ad hominem. Ad against hominem. Man. Against the man. They're speaking against him. You're not right. And so you just know that, right? If you're putting forth some things and people start attacking you personally, they're ad hominem. They're attacking you. They're not attacking the argument. They couldn't attack the argument because the argument was sound. As little as he knew, the argument's totally sound. So they attack him and they cast him out. So he's out of the synagogue. He's done. But it doesn't matter to him. Didn't mean much for a man who had nothing in his life. Been outcast all his life. And then I love the tender care of Jesus in verse 35. Jesus heard that they'd cast him out. And having found him, that means Jesus went on a search, looking for him. And this is similar to the man who was an invalid. Right? Jesus later found him and talked to him. And here it is. Jesus later finds this man and talks to him and gives him comfort. Brings him to himself. Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and having found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" And this honest beggar says, "And who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said to him, "You've seen him, and it's he who's speaking to you." He said, "Lord, I believe," and worshiped him. At the beginning of the chapter, we see this blind beggar without much hope in the world. But by the end of the chapter, we see him having all the hope in the world, believing and trusting in Jesus, the Messiah. And he's really an example for all of us. The book of John is calling us to believe in Jesus that we might have life in his name. And John included this story so that we might see one who didn't believe in Jesus, but had something experience happen in his life, a miraculous, a wonderful thing, and then he came to believe in Jesus. That's the whole point of this story. That he's coming to believe in Jesus. Do you believe in Jesus? Do you believe in Christ? Or are you hardened like the Pharisees? We could add another hardness up here. Another H in my outline. Verse 39. Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind." Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, "Are we also blind?" And Jesus said, "If you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now you say, 'We see,' your guilt remains." How hard these men are. How hard they are against you. They hear something about you, they just hate Jesus. They're hard. They are blind. And so what a contrast. The story begins with a blind man who comes to see. The story ends with those who say they see, but who Jesus says is blind. So what the light of the world is about is to give sight to the blind. And it's to even expose those who profess themselves to see the light that they don't see the light at all because of the hardness of their hearts. Well, we're going to celebrate the Lord's Supper now as we just think and reflect upon Jesus. The Lord's Supper is for those who say, "Yeah, I once was lost, but now I'm found. I once was blind, but now I see." It's for those who experience this amazing thing in their life, Christ coming in, believing and trusting. It's a way that we can remember Christ and the cross of Christ. So if you're with us today and are believing and trusting in Christ, then celebrate the supper with us. We're going to do this every Sunday in Lent. This is the first Sunday of six straight Sundays, and then we'll do it Good Friday. We'll have a good a service as well. So we just think and reflect upon Christ and his work. I just encourage you today, right, just to think about your own testimony. Can you sing with John Newton, right? "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see." That's the story of this man right here. That's the story of many of us in the room, that we once were lost, been found, we once were blind, but now we see the light of the gospel, the glory of God in the face of Christ. And he is our hope. And that's what we do. We eat the bread, symbolizing his death. We drink the cup, symbolizing his death as well, the blood of the covenant. And so we get to do that today. So I'm going to invite the men to come forward, invite the musicians to come up and lead us in a song as they distribute the bread, the elements. And just hold that in your hand, and we will gather together, eat that at the same time together.